This is Indie Book Publishing. Indie Book Publishing is a show about new books and the authors who wrote them. It's an opportunity for prospective readers to hear directly from the writers, to hear what inspired them to write and publish, and to hear all the inside details about their books. And now, Indie Book Publishing.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing Archway Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book is titled Tilly's Magical Christmas Ride, and joining me from California in San Diego is author Lupe Almaguer Cruz. Thank you for joining me today. It's great to visit with you.
Thank you.
This, obviously, because it says Magical Christmas Ride, even I know it's a seasonal book. However, this is your first book, first attempt. What was the reason you decided to write this? What gave you that inspirational spark to write the story? What was your motivation? How did you come about writing this book?
Well, I was writing my memoirs, and then I remembered a dream I had when I was 7 years old, and I was inspired then to spin off and write this children's Christmas book. I was 7 years old. Our family never celebrated any holidays, not even our birthdays. But this year, for the very first time, we were celebrating Christmas. That Christmas Eve, I dreamed that I was under the kitchen table of our home when in walked Santa Claus. All I could see from my view was a pair of black boots walking in that could only belong to Santa. So I reached out and I grabbed a boot. Santa left real quick and did not leave me a gift. He was disappointed that he had found me awake. So that's why it was a unique dream. I was inspired to turn it into a children's book, and that's how it came about, Tilly's Magical Christmas Ride.
Well, share a little of your family setting. You had a number of siblings. How many, and did they have any inspiration or anything that they did that may have triggered this idea of writing a book?
Well, there was, at the time when I was five, there was eight of us, but in the end, my parents ended up having 11 children. And in my life, you know, my childhood was far from idyllic because I was put to work in the fields at the age of five. And every year I missed school for several months at a time because my family needed the income from my work of my small hands. I was born in Texas, but my family traveled from state to state to find work at picking fruits and vegetables. We worked in the fields from sunup to sundown. Therefore, my siblings and I, we had very little time to play. But we would return to Texas in the winter, and it was then that we attended school for about 2 months each year. I knew my ABCs, and I knew how to count, and that was about it. I just wasn't in school much to learn more. The lack of an education plagued me well into my childhood. I struggled to read and write in both in Spanish and English. I lost my hearing in my left ear due to lack of medical care. I wanted simple things as milk. I never had a childhood. We never knew our birthdays. Holidays came and went without us children knowing. We were just so poor. Without money for luxuries such as toys, my siblings and I, we made our own playthings. I remember living in a barn in Ohio, making dolls out of ears of corn. They had silky, beautiful hair. And at the age of seven, my family celebrated Christmas for the first time and only time. I found my mother and my grandmother draping tinsel on our backyard orange tree. And I asked them why they were draping tinsel on the orange tree. My grandmother answered that Santa was coming to our house that night. Santa's pending visit was so exciting that I had trouble sleeping that night. Eventually, I fell asleep, and I had the dream of meeting Santa. I was under our kitchen table when the door to the kitchen opened, and from my view, I saw a pair of black boots that I knew could only belong to Santa. However, when Santa realized that I was still awake, he left in a hurry. I woke from my dream crying. The next morning, I woke up to find that Santa had brought me a tiny doll. But the memory of that Christmas and those happy moments in such stark contrast to others' times stayed with me as I grew. And at the age of 28, I was embarrassed that I couldn't read to my children. So I began to teach myself how to read. Today, I am a successful real estate investor. And my message to everyone is that you can do anything if you're willing to work hard. And when I learned that a friend was writing an autobiography, I felt inspired to write my own story to paper. I was determined not to let the fact that I didn't know how to write stop me. Instead, I studied books at home to see how it was done and taught myself to write page by page. The experience of writing my memoirs was cathartic. I did a lot of crying. When I got to the part about that one Christmas, I was inspired to write that children's Christmas book. And because of my early childhood, I hold a special place in my heart for children. I have taken in foster kids and operated a daycare. Univision, a Hispanic television station, invited me to come to Phoenix for an interview. That interview was aired December 24, 2015, as a Christmas special. I live in San Diego, but in December 22, 2015, for Christmas, I made the 6-hour drive to Phoenix, Arizona, to support a charity called Chicanos por la Causa, which gives meals and Christmas toys to needy children. I donated copies of Tilly's Magical Christmas Ride to help brighten the holidays for those young people. I can't think of anything more rewarding.
That is a remarkable story on a personal level. Your novel or your book that's geared towards children, would you call the story that you have created in Tilly's Magical Ride, Magical Christmas Ride, would you call it an inspirational story?
Oh, yes, because the overall theme of this book is that you can do anything you want as long as you believe in yourself. Because I strongly believe that what there is, where there is a will, there is a way.
You have passed on this positivity to other children, obviously, if you have a daycare center or have engaged in a daycare center and so on. This being your first book, was it difficult because of your challenging history?
It was very challenging, but I kept going. I would work at my daycare during the day, and I eat dinner and go to bed and start writing. And there was this need in me that inspired me to keep going. You know, it was just very important for me to teach myself to write, not only for myself. This need was not only for myself, but also for others. This book is it's enjoyable, very enjoyable, but not only by children, but also by adults. And I have people that have read my book, and I sell some of the books, and they, after they read it, they call me and tell me that their eyes welled with tears, and they felt for the little girl Tilly, the protagonist.
Yes.
In this book.
I will also mention that although this is a children's book with wonderful artwork on the cover, the story inside is actually a story. It's not just a photo book. This would actually appeal to a little older child age as well.
Yes. Adults and children.
You've introduced you've introduced a new reindeer into the mix that no one has heard of before. What was his name?
Rocket.
All right. And
Rocket is an albino reindeer. Santa found him in the woods crying. And Santa called out to him, and frightened, he just sped off. And the way he took off was so fast that Santa thought it was like a rocket. And so he named him Rocket. But after many times of going back to the woods to check on Rocket, you know, finally Rocket started trusting Santa and became Santa's reindeer.
Excellent.
And although he's an albino, he also has large ears, like donkey ears. I mean, he's not your average reindeer.
an interesting character that you've molded into the storyline. Was this a painful experience doing the writing? This must have taken a while, or did it inspire you to continue your authorship?
Yes. I've been writing my life story, and that's how I started first writing my life story. I was inspired by a friend that told me that I was telling her about what had happened to me as a child. And she said, "Lupi, go home and write this book." I went home and I started writing, but I was all over the place. Like, because at the time I was writing like the level of third grade. And a week later she came to visit me. She says, "Let me see what you've written." So I showed her. She goes, "Lupi, let me show you how you start to write." And she wrote like three paragraphs for me. And she said, "This is how you write." And from thereafter, I mean, I started, and I just kept going and going and going. While I was writing, my life story, it was very painful. I did a lot of crying, but it was also, it felt good afterwards. I could go back and read what I have written and not cry anymore, But anyway, when I was writing my life story, then I started to write about children's, about the dream I had at the age of 7. And I thought, wow, this would really make a great children's book. So I spun off and I started writing Tilly's Magic Christmas Ride. I'm writing, I love writing for children. I just found that I just have this, I don't know, I just enjoy it so much. But eventually I want to get back to my life, just to finish writing that book about my life story, because it is, it's a tearjerker.
And inspirational also. And I understand that this writing of Tilly's Magical Christmas Ride has spilled over into possibly two sequels to follow up on.
Yes.
Excellent.
Yes. When I was like three quarters done with Tilly's Magical Christmas Ride book one, I knew that it deserved a sequel, because now I bring the characters that I've mentioned very little about them in book one, which is Rocket and Andy. Andy is Tilly's little brother who is sick with autism. And I bring him back into book two, and also other characters that that play a wonderful role in this story.
Fabulous job, Lupi. Thank you for joining me today and sharing your story. The title again is Tilly's Magical Christmas Ride. My guest author, Lupi Almaguerre Cruz, thank you for joining me today. Where can my listeners get a copy of your books and also keep in touch on books that will come in the future?
Amazon online and Barnes & Noble's online. It's available in soft cover, hardcover, and also as an ebook.
Well, congratulations. You've done a wonderful job considering all of the fabulous details that you have shared with us today, and the fact that it is an inspirational book at its foundation. Thank you for doing the book and for sharing your story with us today.
Thank you so much for having me, listening to me talk about my book. Thank you so much.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you. For Indie Book Publishing, Archway Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
Have you heard? The pages of American Patchwork and Quilting magazine come to life on our new weekly online radio show, American Patchwork and Quilting. Join Pat Sloan, our blogging and quilt designer host, as she talks about the latest trends, ideas, and inspirations. Her guests include quilt pattern designers, authors, quilt shop owners, and our editors. All quilters, just like you. Call in with your questions. Get quilting tips from industry experts. Learn about free patterns. Hear behind-the-scenes stories from our magazines, American Patchwork and Quilting, Quilt Sampler, and Quilts and More. Get the scoop on free stuff. And find out more about the best independent quilt shops in North America. To listen to a live show, tune in Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern. Just log on to allpeoplequilt.com/radio. To hear past shows, go to iTunes and search for American Patchwork and Quilting Radio. We hope you'll join us because we know that quilting changes everything.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, Lulu Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book is titled, Her First Loves, His Only. And joining me from Canada, in Ontario, Canada, north of Toronto, is author L.L. Conrad. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jay.
And may I call you Louise?
Yes.
Thank you, Louise. I appreciate your taking time to visit with me. In my first, in my initial conversation with you, I was assuming this was your first novel, but that was incorrect. You have written at least 8 in this past year. Is that also correct?
Yes, that is correct. I wrote those in under 12 months. I write every day, 7 to 10 in the evening and every weekend.
That's phenomenal. That takes a lot of discipline. Have you always had this passion for writing?
Yes, I've been an avid reader and closet writer since the age of 12, and I have written a countless number of books.
You say you have written since the age of 12. I'm assuming your writing style has changed. The book that we have in front of us has a little more of an adult theme than probably your 12-year-old personality.
Yes. Well, I gravitated to erotic romance, the genre itself, because it goes beyond a classic romance story where the boy meets girl into more interesting directions that challenged me as a writer.
And you say you write daily. 362 pages must have taken a little while to complete. How long did it take to finish this novel?
5 weeks.
Just 5 weeks. I have interviewed some authors that have taken 12 to 14 years to complete their novels. That's an amazing accomplishment. But again, I guess it goes back to discipline. Were there other career paths that you took that prepared you to become an author of this this magnitude?
Yes, I became a registered nurse when I was 26 years old and moved my children with me down to Southern Ontario to work. And that took a lot of work to go to university for 3 years and finish that degree and then work at nursing. And then I retired from that job to do a commercial procurement for hospitals in Ontario, which is a whole different ball game. And so it requires long hours of work and dedication and education. So
you're
sort of set the tone for my life.
Set the tone for a lot of hard work. And this particular novel titled Her First Loves, His Only. Is this similar to the other books you have written, or is it a little bit different, a departure of some type?
They're all different. They all have unique slants. They all press the envelope a little, you know, they all sort of skirt the very complex nature of humans, all their past, their histories, everything they go through. I'm told I'm very a different writer. Nobody has seen some of this writing before. It skirts things that people would possibly be uncomfortable with, but it doesn't make it gruesome or terrible to read. So you're left feeling invigorated, and you enjoy the book after you've finished reading it.
And would you still call this a romance story?
It's romantic because the ending ends in a typical or not so typical fashion of what I consider a romantic novel. It is contemporary eroticism because there are erotic scenes in them, but predominantly it is a romance novel.
Your characters, describe for my listeners the characters. Are they people that we will identify with as we read the book?
I believe that the lead female characters and all the male characters, you will identify, the readers will identify with them because they are very real. We're so used to the typical genre of book where it has, girl meets boy and the girl is younger and the boy could be wealthy or is a businessman. In this genre of writing, it's more about the women may not need the men. And so it's a total twist on the familiar theme that people are used to. And it shows, in my view, the strengths of people, of the evolution of relationships, and how people change as they mature and grow.
Your strongest character, would that be the male or the female in this book?
The both of them, actually, because all stories are taken from both points of view. They're taken from the female point of view, and they're taken from the male point of view, and both are equally strong.
Have you had male readers give you feedback on the contents of your books? And if so, what did they say?
Actually, I have.
I'm of a generation that didn't embrace Twitter and number and Facebook, et cetera. But through this whole process in the last year, I've had to embrace, so many things, Goodreads, chat lines and community forums and Facebook, et cetera. This morning I woke up to 178 emails.
Wow.
On exactly everybody's recommendations or thoughts over the holidays about what they've read either on my blog, etc. And the very interesting of them is there's more feedback from men at the moment who want to befriend me on Facebook, etc., or who are offering their opinion than there are women, which I find interesting.
And you're sure they're not stalking you? I guess that would be a concern I would have, yes. Now, you in writing this novel of 362 pages, do you start with an outline, or how do you begin the process of writing the creative side?
That's interesting. One of the reasons I wrote 8 books in a year was the fact that I start a book and then I have a series of things I want to get said in the book. And then I sort of say, okay, this doesn't fit with this book, and I start writing a second book. So at any one point, I can have 6 books I'm writing at a time. I know it sounds weird, but I often find myself shifting onto a new idea. And I think that's part of the creative process. When I start a book, I don't have a formal outline. The story just flows. It just writes. That's why I can get back into it every day and continue writing. And it's hard to describe unless I've not always been this way. The first book took me almost 5 years to write. So it's a process of how you know where the story has to flow on its own. You start with a germ of an idea. I wake up in the morning, I have a germ of an idea, I start writing it. By the time I go to bed at night, I have the whole book outlined in my head about where I want to go, how the characters are going to relate to each other, what are some of the issues that are going to arise. And it's not drama for the sake of drama. And it's the story is not driven by sex. The story is driven by the story. And that's the difference, I think, about how I think and how I write. And so that's easier to do because you don't have to come up with all new scenarios all the time. You just have to come up with a new story.
You've said this is an erotic novel, at least to some degree. Some would describe it that way. Are there other, shall I put in quotations, action scenes that might attract the reader?
There are some scenes that are can be quite explicit. When I've had them edited or commented on, that people are sometimes uncomfortable. Some of the first scenes of of this first book, Her First Love, His Only, are about finding how the relationship forms with the two lead characters, where the male character finds the female character being raped by 3 other men. And it takes it a step further as to how he frees her and what he does with these men and so on and so forth, and how their whole life is affected by this one incident. And she is uncomfortable accepting that her life becomes, being taken. She's a young person. She's at university. She's uncomfortable with being led down a path that she doesn't think she deserves or is ready for. So, because life can't be all it is at the age of 20 and 21, there has to be more. And living a life, an unrealistic life of where this is the man that she cares for and loves dearly, there has to be more because it can't be this good. So she doesn't believe life can be this good. And so one of the other deep scenes, there's a sex scene whereby one of her fantasies that she didn't even realize she had, where she's on a gourmet table and the food is placed on her body and people are eating the food from her body. So she's like part of the buffet. And for a lot of women, I'm hearing this is one of their fantasies that nobody's ever talked about or mentioned. And I go into quite a bit of detail. One of the things I am is very verbose. And so when I used to write a lot of technical, clinical imagery, the editors would always say, okay, that's way too much detail. You don't need to give that much detail. But I think in sex scenes, you do have to give some detail. You don't have to tell the whole story because you have like people to use their imagination, but you do have to give a certain amount of detail so they can place themselves in the situation and understand what that person is going through and use a little bit of their own imagination to discover what the rest would be.
Her First Love's His Only. Where does the story take place and over what period of time?
It takes place, the first novel of the trilogy takes place in this day and age in Toronto. I had two settings I had to create a two setting view because I had to set up the other two novels. But it begins with the main character, Carly Stevens, who's enrolled in a Toronto university before she becomes a nurse. I find herself forced into later on killing patients for a government agency. The tale continues in different locales, from her retreat up north in a small town, central Ontario, to hospitals in bigger cities such as Hamilton and Toronto. In the various settings that I created over the span of more than a decade, she meets four men, of which two will remain important to her as time goes on. Meeting her lovers first at university, then while on the job and in her own backyard, is a natural progression of how a cycle of acquaintances actually occur in real life. It's how we grow. There was a requirement to set up at least two different settings, as I mentioned, so that I could allow for some flexibility in location. But many Southern Ontarians, for example, have cottages and places to go to get away from the dense population. So it helps to have an isolated retreat or, as a home base for the next two novels that set up the series.
Since you are a Canadian living in Ontario and it's winter as we are doing this interview, any winter scenes in here that we might embrace?
There is a winter scene when Carly, the lead character, meets Ron Ronalds. He's an American, and he works for the American government. He's located on her site when she's home for Christmas, looking for a Christmas tree, and found in the bunkie. And he has been shot, and she several times, and she has to perform surgery on him. So the whole process, you walk it through with her, and they develop a relationship, a very strong relationship. He is also one of the two men that are with her to almost the end of the story. So it is very much a winter scene, crackling through the snow, seeing the blood in the snow from where he's going into a small bunkie to hide, how she gets him into the house with a toboggan, and so on and so forth.
Has anyone in the creative industry, such as media, movies, that type of thing, that side of the industry, have they looked at any of your novels and decided they might be adaptable to a movie?
I've been approached by a number of people to consider that. I'm not sure I'm up for that, to be quite honest. I know maybe people would rush to do that. It's possibly not in my character to be up front and center. I'm not afraid to speak. I speak at conferences. I'm also a speaker for my company. I'm not worried about that, so I'm not shy. I'm just thinking that, do I want to go to Hollywood? Do I want to have to pitch my novel in Hollywood? I don't know. But it has been suggested that at least two of them, of the eight books, would be good for that. And maybe, it's only been, they haven't been on the market even a year. So maybe in 2017, I'll change my mind.
Well, hopefully we'll have something to talk about in the future. Louise, what were the challenges in writing this? You have mentioned that you are really balancing maybe six or seven novels at once. Was that the main challenge, or were there others?
Very often it's very difficult to remove yourself from the story, make your own personal interactions with your patients as a nurse, with your family as a child, with others, and try not to use them. They can be fodder for some information, but try to make it more fictional as opposed to personal. So it was making that division very clear between the characters and myself. And that is harder to do the older I get, it seems like I want to push more of myself into the characters, and I'm trying to let the characters be unique to themselves. So I think that for me is the biggest challenge, separating reality and fiction.
Louise, you've done a wonderful job on this book, 362 pages, the title of which is Her First Loves, His Only. Louise, where do we get copies of your book?
Lulu.com has all of the copies for all of the books, and you can go in there. You can get them through my blog too, llconrad.com. There's a direct link on the website for purchasing either e-books or hardcover or softcover books.
Louise, thank you for joining me today, and best of luck in the future. Hope to visit with you again. Again, the title of this one, Her First Loves, His Only, L.L. Conrad, has been my guest. Louise, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Jay.
My pleasure. For Lulu Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You're listening to Indie Book Publishing, and we'll be right back after these messages.
It's the Fitness Minute with fitness expert Annette Hammond.
When your focus is to lose weight or maintain your present weight, exercising effectively to burn the most calories is crucial. You want to give yourself every advantage to burn as many calories as possible. One good tip is to do your strength training exercises standing up so you can keep your heart rate up. Another tip is to perform multi-joint exercises when you can. For example, as you're doing a forward lunge, add bicep curls while you're coming up from the lunge. Another example is to execute a wide squat, and as you're coming up from the squat, perform a shoulder press. By doing these multi-joint exercises, you're putting more demands on your body, keeping your heart rate up, and working more muscles at the same time. The goal is to burn the most calories during that workout. I'm Annette Hammond. To hear other fitness and weight loss tips, visit our website at AnnetteHammond.com.
Welcome back to Indie Book Publishing, helping authors publish, promote, and sell their books around the world. Now, back to your host, Steve Jorgensen.
Greetings for Indie Book Publishing, West Bow Press. This is J. Douglas Barker. The book has a catchy title. It's titled The Legacy Family, Father, Son, and Holy Coach. Love that. The author is joining me from California, Kip Colson. Welcome, sir, to the program.
Thank you.
Pleasure visiting with you. You are a numbers guy. I can tell by your book. You have 340 pages. That's a pretty good number. Share a little of your background history and how this book got written.
Sure. Well, the quickie background is I got out of college in 1967, went to Bank of America, became a banker, and did that for about 11 years, became vice president and head of a real estate department at a local office. One of my clients, who was a real estate developer, asked me to join him in his commercial development firm. So I did about 11 years in real estate development up until the early 90s when the real estate market was not very good, and so I needed to keep income coming in and change from the development world into the financial planning world. And I've been in financial planning since basically 1993.
Financial planning from a consumer standpoint is one that's filled with mystery. You love detail, apparently, in order to get a grasp on the best way to approach finances. Your book, is it something that will be available to someone like me who is absolutely indigent when it comes to finances and laying up that nest egg for the future?
I believe so. I really designed the book to be applicable to anybody who has to deal with finances, but understanding that unlike most other financial advisors in our world who only focus on the money side, in our experience, we try to focus with the combination of the people side of the family and the money side, because what we've learned in coaching families is that we never know for sure which is impacting the other. Sometimes the money is impacting the relationships in the family, unfortunately, negatively. And then sometimes, because of family dynamics, it impacts the financial well-being of the family. So we are, I think, one of the few financial planning firms that really addresses both of both sides of the family concurrently. So a lot of times families will go out and get the relational therapist to help them with the people side, and then they get the financial advisors helping with the money. But if those two aren't coordinated and collated in a fashion where they're working together, then the family still goes into a destruction mode.
Is that the underlying theme of Chapter 2, Why Is This Happening to My Family?
Exactly. The term, the scientific term, is called entropy, and entropy is the second law of thermodynamics, which basically says everything in the universe is basically going from the complex to the simple. And families are no different. Once you start to throw a lot of complexity into the family, and unfortunately wealth is usually one of those things, so the more things people own, the more opportunity there will be for the family to start fighting over those things. And the biggest issue is trust, and communication deteriorates to a point where the family just completely falls apart, unfortunately.
From your experience and oversight of families in distress financially, for example, those who are maybe small business owners or trying to get something launched or are self-employed as I am, a DBA, finances are not always predictable. You can't always plan. a simple retirement set aside. What is the easy solution to that, or is there one?
Well, again, we like to think that planning is at least a positive solution to that, in the sense that you're right. It's there's no perfect world, and all the planning in the world isn't necessarily going to solve all of the problems. But planning, the old cliche is, if failing to plan is a plan to fail. And especially, again, when we're dealing with families, and as you just indicated, with businesses, the minute you put a business ownership or business enterprise into the family, that complexity goes way up. The analogy I like to use is that it's a little bit like having the family airplane, and mom and dad know how to fly it, but then at 30,000 feet, they decide we're getting out, we're going to let the kids figure out how to get this thing back to the airport and get it on the ground. Well, that's just not going to work. It's going to be a plane crash. So unfortunately, even business owners, they may do really well operating their business, but for whatever reason, all of those skills never transfer to their family. And so if you use good business succession planning, we actually like to use the word progression instead of succession. If you use good business progression planning and take those same disciplines and apply them into the family, that's really what we do, is we take that, how do you plan now to make that transition so that when mom and dad are gone, that next level of management just moves right up and keeps going because they're already up to speed.
The title, The Legacy Family, Father, Son, and Holy Coach in quotations, the significance of that, where did that title come from? Are you just one of those guys that likes to have a play on words, or how did that come about?
Well, I do like to have a play on words, so that's probably part of it. But the bigger issue is, which goes kind of the underlying theme of the book, is you have to have the right wisdom that works time and time again. And we just found that that wisdom is based in biblical wisdom. And so really it's a mix. The book is a mix of real world challenges and tools and strategies, but then backing that up with the fact that we've got this biblical wisdom. And when I looked at it, I went back and I said, well, really the whole concept of the Father, Son, Holy Coach, or Holy Ghost, was a little bit of a play on words. And because what we do is the coaching aspect of working with families, we just felt like there was that connection where that we've got the model in place. We just got to follow that model, and we got to follow the rules that the model established. And so hence, that's how the name came about.
Well, Kip, this is, I guess, would be referred to maybe as a teaching book, perhaps. Do you have real life incidences or stories that are included in your book?
Yeah, I do. And a few of those stories are, as you say, real life in today's world. And then there's quite a few really real life stories, again, based on biblical stories. So, for example, the conflict between Jacob and Esau is in there, and it's a classic one. The struggle that King David had going through his family, and basically his whole family being destroyed, and his own son attempting to kill him. And it all goes back to this destruction based on this lack of trust and communication. So, yeah, there's a little bit of both the real world today, and so there's no names, but there's real world people that we deal with every day, as well as historical people.
Do you have to have a spiritual bend in order to enjoy the book, or is this something that will appeal to anybody that has an interest in finances?
I really designed this book to not be geared only to one, I'll call it the Christian world. I really wanted this book to have wide application, and my hope is that everybody can pick up this book no matter what their belief is, and I actually say that several times in the book, and that a lot of the principles, a lot of the rules that apply here really don't depend on your faith background. It really is just good, I'll call it common sense. And if you apply these rules, no matter what you believe personally, it can change your life. And that's really the, so you, to answer your question, is I really wanted this to be very broad in the sense of reaching everybody that needs the help that we like to think this book can provide.
Would you call your style easy to read, easy to understand, and easy to follow?
Yeah, I think I am. I would tell you that a lot of times the compliments, if you will, that I get from a client is that, wow, you really made that easy for me to understand. So that's really the attempt. I mean, it is, especially when you're dealing with family dynamics, that can be very complex. But I'd like to think that I've boiled it down, if you will, to a level where it's going to be easily related by anybody who reads the book.
You have over 21 chapters. The last three, I think, are provocative and thought-provoking. Number 19, what will your family story be? That is a provocative title and a challenge. And then you have a step-by-step wrap-up, and the last one word, that's a last wrap-up of the layout of your book. What is the inspiration or the challenge of what will your family story be?
Well, again, I think, unfortunately, in today's world, with the busyness, with the technology, and also with the geographical dispersion that families have, we don't have the tradition, we don't have the principles and the values necessarily being transferred from one generation to the next. Again, legally, the money side, the financial side of a family has to transfer because of estate planning and legal requirements. But the transfer of the values and the principles of a family just isn't happening. And so a large part of what you just described in those last three chapters are really saying, here's how you hold it all together. Here's how you keep the family as a unit, even though they are geographically dispersed, and give them a purpose for life that can go far beyond just gathering more and more assets. And, you know, and one of the examples I always talk about when I'm talking to clients is, you know, why do we know the names Kennedy and Rockefeller and Getty and some of these people that we've known for history? Well, it's because early on they realized that the family was the brand. The family was what we needed to hold together, and if we kept it all together, we would actually both financially and relationally benefit everybody in the family much more than if we give it away. And statistically, throughout history, wealth, about 70% of the family wealth gets lost every time it moves from one generation to the next. So in effect, by the end of the third generation, what mom and dad created back here will be completely gone and the kids will be without. In fact, the proverb everybody uses in our industry is called shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves in three generations.
Wow. That's challenging. You, in Chapter 9, one thing that's certainly very valuable about the way you've outlined the book is if you look at the chapter heading, you kind of get an idea of what's included in that chapter. Chapter 9, values are more valuable than valuables. I think that tells a story just in itself. Kip, you're dealing with a very complex issue. Is this a book that will answer everything? Is this all we need as far as finances, or do we need someone else involved in the process?
Jay, that's a really good question. And the answer is this book is not a self-help book in the sense that you can read through it and then go off and do everything yourself. And in fact, I even in the book encourage people not to attempt to do that because they'll make very serious mistakes. And again, we're dealing with relationships, so these are the kind of mistakes that can have very long-lasting impact on a family. We really believe that you need to have a third-party, objective, non-attached, somebody who can kind of you know, look beyond the forest for the trees, also see the emotions, can feel those emotions that the family's going through, can see the body language, and can see where the breakdown in communication is happening. So we strongly recommend that the family always try to include a coach to help them with these problems. And again, not just the family therapist or the financial advisor, but the coach who can blend those two activities so they're working together.
Well, that's good advice. Having someone that is not emotionally vested in the process is certainly a very important bit of advice.
We believe so.
How long did it take you, Kip, to complete your book?
Well, it's kind of interesting. It's kind of fun in that I think in round numbers, I'm probably about 12 months, about a year. And interestingly enough, I was able to write that on my cell phone. And
really?
That's always the reaction. But that's because I always had my cell phone with me. So anytime I had downtime, whether it be lunchtime, whether I'm sitting in an airport, whether I'm waiting in the doctor's office or whatever, I could always pull out the cell phone and start working on the book. So, about 12 months.
That's phenomenal. And again, 340 pages. Kip, is there another book in the future? Is there a follow-up to this one, The Legacy Family?
Well, the answer is I'm not sure, but yeah, I've been given some thought. I'd like to try to maybe do something a lot shorter that's geared towards the children in the family, starting to prepare them, because again, what we've seen too often is, and that's really the whole point of the book, is mom and dad unfortunately aren't doing a great job of preparing their children to deal with not only, again, the money side of the family, but also the people side. So, yeah, I'd like to maybe follow it up with a book that's a little bit geared more towards the youth and start to prepare them and really have it as a tool that mom and dad can sit down with their kids and start teaching them how to handle money.
Fabulous. This, your first book, is titled The Legacy Family, Father, Son, and Holy Coach. My guest, Kip Colson. That's with a K, K-I-P. K-O-L-S-O-N. Kip, my listeners need to get a copy of this. How do they do so?
Well, they can go right directly to www.kipcolson.com. It's also available at Amazon, at Barnes & Noble, and at Westbow Press.
Fabulous. They can also go to the local bookseller and ask them to order it in for them. The title again, The Legacy Family, Father, Son, and Holy Coach. Thank you for joining me today and sharing your story.
Oh, thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
Honored to visit with you. For Indie Book Publishing, Westbow Press, this is J. Douglas Barker.
You've been listening to Indie Book Publishing with your host, Steve Jorgensen. Join us again next week at noon Eastern as Steve interviews another great author.